This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
My name is Madeline Morris. I host the Question Time series here at the Wheeler Centre. My day job is as a reporter for 7:30 on the ABC. This is our last Question Time for the year, so it's great that you've all made it tonight. It's a really fantastic discussion that we can have here tonight on a really, really important topic. And I don't know how many of you saw Four Corners last night, but after seeing Four Corners last night with what some young people think about the world, I was thinking, oh my God, I really need some good news tonight about the opportunities for young people. And these are the people to deliver it to you this evening. So, I mean, if we're to believe our new Prime Minister, there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian. But is that what our young Australians think? There are some fairly scary statistics out there. On average these days, it takes a full-time education leaver 4.7 years to get a full-time job. And in 1986, it was 1 year. So that's a fairly scary statistic. 70% of young people's entry-level jobs are at risk of automation in the future. One in five 16 to 17-year-old girls have depression. I didn't know that. I saw that last night on Four Corners. So that's the bad stuff. That said, there is some good stuff. Young people are better educated than ever before. They have easy access to the world, literally at their fingertips. And partially through these digital technologies, but also just through the evolution of the world, their voices are being heard more and more than ever before. So what does it all add up to? Is it a gleaming future, or is it a depressing mud pit of machine-fuelled unemployment? Or can it be both? And what are the challenges and the exciting things facing young people today? So really, these people are the people to answer those questions. And tonight is all about you. It's all about questions from the audience. It's not a panel discussion, so it's a full-hour Q&A. So I'm going to introduce our panel and then kick off with some questions just to get moving. But then please put your hand up. We've got two ushers over here. And they just put your hand up and they will come to you to ask you a question. And we've got about an hour and it goes very, very fast. So please do get your question in. So let me start off introducing the panel. First of all, we have Richard Punjabi. He is the founder and chair of Langur, which is an advertising agency of creative technologists with more than 150 people across Asia. He was also the founding chair of the Australia-India Youth Dialogue. He doesn't do that anymore, but he's still extremely involved in that and sits on various other boards as well. Jan Owen is the CEO of the Foundation for Young Australians, which is an organisation which is all about backing the next generation. She was also the Executive Director of Social Ventures Australia. She founded the Create Foundation, which is the national consumer body for children and young people in out-of-home care, and her latest book, she's written two, her latest book is called The Future Chasers, which came out last year. Holly Ransom, some of you may have seen on Q&A last night. She's the CEO of Emergent Solutions, where she helps companies achieve dynamic intergenerational workforces, leadership and social outcomes. She's got a list of achievements as long as my arm, so I'm going to pare it down. In 2012, she was the youngest person to be named in Australia's 100 most influential women, and she also became the world's youngest ever Rotary president. And in 2014, the Prime Minister appointed her to chair the G20 Youth Summit. So between them, they know collectively a few things about the future of youth in Australia. So I just want to kick off with you, Richie, and ask, as someone, I mean, I read out some scary statistics, and I think that some of us can get caught up in the bad news. As someone coming from originally outside Australia, how do you see opportunities for young people in Australia?
It's a really tough question, actually, to begin with. I think the way I was brought up, I grew up in India. The way I was brought up and the kind of opportunities I had, a lot of people around me wouldn't have had, which was obviously a privilege, and that led on to being coming to Australia to do an undergraduate degree in computer science. Especially doing a university degree here, the education system in India, and I would say I went to good schools, despite that, the education system in India follows a certain trend, and it wasn't until I came to Australia that I sort of started asking fundamental questions of the world. The university ecosystem here was very helpful for me to do that. And that sort of opened my world, made me think about the world that didn't have borders, made me think about the environment where opportunity was endless. I was able to do things I didn't think I could do. Sitting on a panel here, you might not believe that I was one of the most shy guys you could ever come across. But opportunities at university sort of opened my worldview, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I think when I think about that today, having done what I have done in the last few years, I think for young Australians, the ecosystem here, you have like people here, young people here, are incredibly lucky to be here, to be born in this environment, to to grow up here for that matter, and have the opportunities that you do, because a lot of people around the world don't.
Mm-hmm. Which is not necessarily the impression that we all get,
right.
Is it? And Jan, when people come to you, you know, you back the next generation, what are people telling you that they want help backing with?
Well, there's a different kind of answers to that, I guess, around, you know, what is it that young people are looking for, but also what are their parents looking for and what are teachers looking for. There's a, you know, a young person is not a kind of an island, and I think that's a really good thing, by the way. And I think where they are an island, we've seen some of these, you know, really challenging things that happen to young people. So it's very important that young people are actually supported and that they're wrapped around with support and with school and with family and with teachers and with friends. All those things are really, really important. But I guess what they want, or what I, you know, what I think is the thematics that we're picking up, are a couple of things. Number one, we've got a new Prime Minister, who has, you know, got a very, very strong rhetoric around innovation and agility and adaptability. And it's fantastic to have that rhetoric. We see very little evidence, really, in young people on a day-to-day basis that they could literally turn that on and become that person that the Prime Minister wants us all to become. And one of the reasons is that we don't actually have a whole lot of systems and supports around young people that actually really prepare them for that kind of different opportunities or the different worldview that our Prime Minister has around our country. So there is a gap in the rhetoric to the reality about what's happening for young people in this country. I don't have a problem with the rhetoric. In fact, I think it's right, but we do need to understand what's the reality, and therefore what is the distance that we need to travel, and how will we travel that distance quickly to get young people ready and prepared for a very, very different future, which is what is being articulated really clearly in lots of reports, including from FYA.
Mm-hmm. And Holly, you have travelled around the world, but you also spend a lot of time here in Australia. I mean, what do you see, picking up on what Jan has just said, needs to change to turn some of that rhetoric into reality?
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation, and it's one Jan and I talk about a lot, but it's certainly one I faced up close last year with the G20 role in particular. And one of the things I find really interesting about this conversation is how often they're held in isolation from engagement of young people themselves. I remember the absolute quintessential experience for me with regards to this was a particular forum of the G20. It was a three-day conference on youth apprenticeships and youth guarantees. So this whole, how do we tackle youth unemployment? One of the biggest issues in the world, you know, one in three young people that aren't in education, training or employment. And we fundraised to get to this particular summit. We weren't supported to do any of that international work, but we believed that was our issue we wanted to take to world leaders. We had to be at the table. So we got ourselves there, and for 3 days I sat in this forum waiting for the young people to show up. You know, you're fixing a system that is proven to be fundamentally flawed in quite dramatic fashion with the numbers of young people that we're seeing disengage from the employment system right now. For 3 days, I was left waiting. You know, there were no young people.
Who was there?
These were all predominantly over 55 Anglo-Saxon males. And
what a surprise. Mm-hmm. I'm shocked.
Yeah, it's not unique, is it, in the situation we often find around leadership tables and board tables. You know, all too true, that terrible statistic that we've got more men called Peter on Australian boards than we do women. So, which...
Women called
Peter. Is that actually
Peter.
True?
Yeah, we've got more men, percentage-wise, as directors of ASX 100 boards in this country than we do women. Like, that's alarming. So it's not unique by any stretch, but it's part of the challenge. Like, to me, these are the people that design the system that we're now trying to rethink how we do, because we're seeing that it's not working. And you're doing it with the same people who designed the original system. And for me, that's like shaking a magic eight ball and expecting a miraculous ninth option to pop up. You know, you've got to change the variables that are inputting into the conversation in order to change the outcome. And to Jan's point, part of what we do need to do is to be able to move out of the conversation and into action. You know, my hope is that in part with the innovation agenda piece that we're going to see announced in December, there's going to be the start of this is how we're going to do this through the education system, this is how we're going to do this financially, and a whole raft of other measures.
So was that a valuable experience then, or was that a waste of time?
Do you know what? It was a really valuable experience. I mean, in part because what we did last year with the issue of youth unemployment, we were the first youth summit in the history of the G20 to actually be able to influence the World Leaders Declaration. And a year ago yesterday, to get measures signed off by the G20 that were addressing this issue and entrenched in every single of the 20 country action plans and employment plans. And one of the things was that there were a lot of dominoes that had to tip to make that eventual outcome happen. And part of the benefit of being at the table, and we managed to fight our way to, you know, kick the door open and get the opportunity to be at the table last year. Part of that was building relationships with the bureaucrats, building relationships with ministers, these behind-the-scenes channels that often young people don't have the access to, and it limits the ability for us to be able to influence outcomes and influence the conversation. So it was important to that end, even though in that meeting we didn't achieve anything.
Just on that point, though, one of the challenges I find in the ecosystem is the lack of belief in the agency of young people. Mm. And often when you give people like Holly access, you're suddenly influencing change at scale that doesn't really happen. And that is a fundamental societal issue, the way we've designed our economies. It's an experience always wins, which is not a bad thing. Experience is crucial, but so is fresh ideas, so is youth enthusiasm, young people's spirit, and so on.
Rashid, to your point, that's kind of an industrial age thinking
exactly.
model, right? You know,
exactly.
that whole time in service equals rank. And now we're in a knowledge economy, and part of what we've got to do is adapt the way that we lead and work to the fact that ideas, solutions, leadership can come from anywhere.
But we do hear so much about disruption and disruptive technologies, and, you know, you only have to look at Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, he's obviously the poster child, but there are plenty of little mini Mark Zuckerbergs all over the world. Is that still the case, or is it just in government circles that people are not catching up?
No, it's interesting. This is so I'll give you a reference point of the Indian economy. We do a lot of business in India, and in India, the IT... everyone knows about the influence India has in the IT services business. And a large part of the conversation in Indian circles is the Indian IT industry exists because the government did not catch up to it fast enough.
Mm.
And what is really interesting about that notion is the fact that where young people get a chance, and business is a good example where there aren't as many barriers because markets sort of exist in a certain way, young people are showing what they are able to achieve. Whereas a lot of other areas, you don't have the same sort of ability for young people to come up through the ranks as easily.
And particularly, I think, with that statistic that I read out at the very beginning, which comes from one of your reports, Jan, that now the average person leaving full-time education takes 4.7 years to get into full-time work, which is terrifying, really, because if we're still working in a system which is predicated on experience wins out, how do you even get that experience? Is that something that you deal with a lot?
Well, I think that piece of data is really interesting because it talks to a couple of things. Number one, it talks to actually what is being well articulated now is this mismatch between what young people are studying at university or at TAFE and what's going on in the job market. Mm. So something like, and this is conservatively, 60% of what students are studying right now in Australia will not be in existence as a job. That field of study will not be in existence as a job in the next few years, but inside 10 years. So that's the one thing. But I guess what the 4.7 years says, that's already begun. So we keep talking about it as a future state, but actually it's already happened. So right now, 20 to 24-year-olds, 30% of them that are unemployed or underemployed, it's because of this churn. It's because actually the thing they studied doesn't exist or it's actually changing so rapidly. And that's not to say, you know, for all the students in the room, you know, need to go out and sort of throw yourself off the bridge. I, you know, particularly lawyers and journalists who I talk to a lot.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a pretty
endangered
lawyers.
Species.
But actually, you know, and journos are a great example, actually, aren't they? Because 10 years ago we thought journalism was dead and yet... Actually, the whole disruption in publishing, the whole disruption in terms of online and social media has spawned an entire new generation but different kind of journalist. And so it is a whole career. And
generally an underpaid journalist, if paid at all, is part of the problem.
People, and that's the other thing, right? So, you know, this... We've our data says that we can expect, and this is we're being really conservative purposefully, we can expect a 15-year-old today to have 14 jobs in four different industries across their lifetime. That is radically different to their parents or grandparents, and that's the reason we need to rethink the entire system.
Can I grab a microphone down here? If you don't, I don't hope you don't mind me putting you on the spot. But I saw your jaw drop there. How old are you?
I was going to say, isn't it welcome to these guys?
Youngest
audience members.
Yeah, good on you.
I'm 14 years old.
14. So that was that stat for 14-year-olds, Jan? Did you say
15?
15 year olds.
Okay. Pretty 14, close. 15. Pretty scary though.
Is that scary to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
So really intimidating. Dad always said, be prepared to have about four jobs, but 14. Oh.
And how are you preparing for that? And how are your teachers preparing you for that?
They're not really.
What are you studying at school, can I ask? Are you doing any coding or any like?
Not really. Okay. No. It's not compulsory.
And do you do any business study stuff yet or any entrepreneurship?
No.
Just say, I've got a friend, I'm 12, and I've got a friend that does coding just out of his own will, so...
So he doesn't do it at school? He just does it...
Yeah, he's actually not allowed to now, I don't know why, but they've stopped allowing him to do it, but he really loves coding, and so, yeah.
Right, okay. So how do you guys feel about, you know, your outlook there? You said that... So, and we'll come to your questions in a second, but as the youngest audience members, I did want to hear from these guys, seeing as we are actually speaking about them. So how do you feel about your prospects, not only in the job, but for your life? Or do you worry most about your job?
It's kind of crazy considering you could go to university for 4 years just for sort of one job or maybe two, and then considering then you've got to plan for four different sort of industries, it's kind of scary as well. Yeah.
And are you still thinking, though, that the university trajectory is going to be what you aim to do?
I'd hope so, but you never know, you know. What comes will come and you just got to live by it.
So
go with the flow attitude. I love it, buddy.
Nice. That's going to stand you in
place. Yeah, I know. That's exactly the attitude you need for 14 different jobs. That's awesome.
Thank you.
She'll be right.
So, but what is the answer to that question? And please do put your hand up if you've got questions. And we'll come to you next, sir. Yep. What is the answer to that question? Yep. Because at the moment our model is still very much you go to school for 12 years or 13 years. Yep. You go to university for 4 years. You probably, if you're a journalist and you want to have a job, go off and do a master's for 2 years where you get in because you're not going to get a job.
Because you think you're going to get a better
new norm.
You know, that is a systemic issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So we've got, well, let's work backwards from that. So what our report did say is that we've got actually some of the most educated young people in the world. So brilliant, you know, really, really good. That's why that 30% number, there's a lot of what we describe as underemployed young people. So your awesome hipster barista that you love getting coffee from has probably got 2 degrees. They're underemployed. So that's the number one thing. Work backwards from that. Let's go right back to the beginning. We've got one of the best primary school education systems in the world. Our primary school is great. So if you've got a five-year-old, I'm actually not that worried about your five-year-old. I'm more worried, sorry, you guys, not you specifically. It's not about you specifically, but I'm more interested in what we're doing for you, because what happens for you in the next 10 years, even 5 or 6 years, will actually make a huge difference. And right now we've got a high school education, and you called it out, that is not actually fit for purpose. This 14 jobs in four different industries is not a bad thing.
No.
You know, when
it's
I you say to 15-year-old classes of girls and young women and young men, which, so there's a job, you have 37 years and you get a gold pen at the end of it, or there's a job where you work for yourself for some time, you work for someone else, you work with a group of people, and which one would you like? And everyone says, we want that one. We love that idea of flexibility. Mm. So that's not the issue. You may actually have an incredibly exciting working life. My issue and our advocacy is around, are you being prepared for it? Are you getting the right stuff in high school? Right now, everyone agrees, including, by the way, people who run the systems, that our high school education is not cutting it yet for you to set you up for that future. It was great for a different time. Mm. It's not great for the future. Okay. But we will make it great because we are on it and we are absolutely connected and hitting on you guys need to be set up for success. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Give us your phone numbers and we'll make sure. Your addresses.
Well, obviously I'm not 15, but I've had 5 different career streams and 9 different jobs in my working life and I'm refusing to retire.
Good.
So it'll be an ongoing effort. Yeah. But I also mentor university students.
Love that.
I'm originally a technologist. That only lasted 3 years. Mm. And then other things went on and up. The point I'd like to make, though, you were asking the question about the misfit between or the misconnection between the education system and preparing students for jobs. As an employer, may I just offer the view, it is not the role of the education system anymore to prepare students for employment. Mm. The employers will do that. But we're getting the wrong raw material.
So you said the employers will do that.
They'll do that. Mm. That's right. Yes. I mean, there are certain generic broad skills, but a lot of the training will happen in the workplace.
Yes. Mm. Yes.
I need people who can think.
Yes.
I need people who can problem solve.
Mm. Yes.
So you need a broader range of particularly soft skills, as they're called, married to some hard-edged stuff that has been largely dropped out of, or the bar has been lowered in our total education system over the last 30 or 40 years. Mm. Unless we raise that bar again, you're not going to get students coming through with the skills to do coding or to do problem solving or to have analytical skills. And that's what's missing in the system at the moment.
And I think you're preaching to the choir maybe. So, I mean, in terms of specifically, as an employer, Richia, when you employ people, what are the characteristics that you are looking for in them?
Yeah, I mean, and it's a really good point. Fundamentally, it's amazing. I mean, I don't run the business anymore, the day-to-day of that business. But when I was hiring actively, I actually always skipped the degrees. What I was really interested in always was the cover letter, what they wrote, what they'd already researched, and what I always looked for was experience, if they had any. Often I would look for activities that they're doing outside because that made them interesting, they had a broader life. And then that conversation would often lead on to how that applies to. We are actually fairly good at training people once they're in the job.
Why don't you explain what your business does, actually, so that everyone's got the context for that?
So Langur effectively is a digital agency, so mostly advertising, but websites, applications, online marketing. Mm-hmm. We're starting to become a broader church than that. We're diversifying into different areas. But that's largely the business. And in our case, skills are very important. Technical skills are especially very important. But often we're hiring people on the fundamentals that don't involve those specific technical skills, but the ability to reason, the ability to ask high quality questions, the ability to communicate because we're in different geographies and so on. And that's what we look for. We train them up on skills.
And you've just spent the past 3 days in Canberra, Jan, haven't you, speaking to department heads, or I don't know who you've been speaking to, but speaking to people in departments about these things, and how receptive are they? I'm sure they're beyond the rhetoric into actually turning it into action.
They're definitely beyond the rhetoric. I guess one of the challenges of government, and forgive you know, I'm do the mea culpa in advance for anybody who works in government in the room, but one of the challenges for government is clearly about how you join up responses. So, you know, we went and we do this all the time, you know, spend time in Canberra and speaking with different government departments, but the ability for them to really have a cohesive approach around these challenges is very, it is extremely difficult. So they will say great things, they will even have great policies, and they will even fund really interesting programs. But again, that's not serving to our friend here who said, you know, and we've tried to articulate this. We've now called these skills enterprising skills, and we've said that we need a new foundation. So alongside your maths and English, you need a skill set. It's called enterprising skills. It's well articulated internationally. There are 10 skills in it: digital literacy, financial literacy, communications, collaboration, problem solving, etc. That needs to become the new normal. That needs to become the new baseline. Every year level should be doing work in that area. And then we'll see this kind of very different outcome for young people going out with a different set of skills and ways of thinking. But you try to go to Canberra and say to three or four different agencies, government departments, we need to see that represented, and you need to qualify it, build it into the national curriculum, build it into what employers do and how employers respond to young people. That is a very big challenge in this country. And Federation doesn't help, just by the way. just saying.
Yes, please.
Thank you for mentioning Federation. I was sitting in my chair going, but Canberra doesn't run schools.
Yes, 100%.
And Canberra, respectfully, doesn't actually deal with business. It deals with consultants and lobbyists and people who speak on behalf of business, but it doesn't speak to business and doesn't speak to schools. Whether they should or not, that's another question. But where are our state governments in all of this, in a constitution that says Canberra and our Federation doesn't give the responsibility to Canberra? It is actually our state governments.
Yeah.
Who wants to tackle that one?
I'll give Holly a crack. I've got some things to say.
Yeah,
about
I was going to say, you've probably got more of a feel for the inner workings of COAG and where different state premiers are at on this issue. I mean, your point's absolutely right. One of the challenges that we have, and that's part of what we're hoping will be looked at as part of the federalism white paper and this tax white paper. I kind of don't know where one stops and the other starts, to be honest. They're blurred a little bit. But is this the federal structure? Because the challenge that we've got in all these areas is, despite the fact they don't control vertical fiscal imbalance, the idea that the state governments basically take in no revenue themselves and yet are responsible for almost 90% of service delivery that we are beneficiaries and recipients of day in, day out, creates this really interesting power situation where you've got tied grants. You know, money is conditionally given by federal government in Canberra to do health and do education according to certain frameworks, certain policy settings, and certain ways that things have to be rolled out. So it's this interesting piece where, and part of, I think, was seen in the challenge of the move towards the national curriculum and that whole schmozzle, what do you call it? That whole process speaks to how difficult that operating model is. You know, not only are you trying to coordinate, as Jan mentioned, multiple federal agencies to get agreement on, okay, what does the structure look like? What is the rollout? What does the implementation look like? How do we do the curriculum? How do we skill up teachers? Then you've got to roll it out across disparate operating models and intertwine it into, as you said, state agencies that work differently, state departments that function differently. So it is a huge part of the challenge.
I think some of the best examples of great work obviously comes out of the state system, because they're actually doing the interaction and doing the state, you know, the frontline work. I think the challenge, again, is, though, how do you and we've not cracked this in Australia. How do you propagate then the best work, and how do you replicate the best work without people becoming extremely territorial, which is, you know, literally and metaphorically, around what they do? So COAG, I always thought the COAG process and COAG trials that have often been done around health and other areas in this country over the last 25 years have been very, very, very powerful. Mm. COAG comes and goes in its power and in its influence based on what's happening in the federal government, who's running the show. You know, how we do things around here changes dramatically at the federal level based on who's running it. But that mechanism, which should actually be multi-partisan, I think, is a really, really good mechanism because it enabled us to, across states and territories, try different things, understand what works and why, replicate and roll those out, you know, and so on. And as I said, health has been a great example of that in Australia. Education maybe not so much yet. But it's a mechanism, and I, you know, I get distressed when we don't use the mechanisms that that are really well constructed, actually, to get the change we want to see.
But and the fundamental challenge with education is no one really knows what the best model fundamentally is, and they don't want to risk a whole curriculum, the future of young people. The hope, though, is in the fact that there are a lot of young upstarts trying really different programs and going like one school at a time, delivering different curriculum, mechanisms of different curriculum to prove the model. And once they get that right, then they're rolling it out to hundreds of schools. And so I think if the bureaucrats don't lead the way, I think there are bright young people already running super smart businesses. They'll find to pull them along that journey.
The challenge with that, though, is a certain type of young person's going to find that. And our challenge still is how do we make sure that every young person is provided with those skills and capabilities. And that speaks to the advocacy work that Jan's such a champion of, is we need to make sure it's not a handful of young people who are fortunate to be in the schools that are resourced or fortunate to be able to afford the extracurricular opportunities or to get their hands on that learning and development. We need to make sure that the skills young people need to be set up for success in an era of uncertainty are provided to all our young people as part and parcel of being in an Australian school.
Are there any countries that do that better than Australia or other countries?
Different countries do different things better.
You've just been on your international tour.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's different countries have got different approaches to Rashia's point, I think. The UK has gone really hard after a particular model that's this kind of comprehensive school model. The US has gone private, you know, about charter schools and a whole different model that's actually funded by business. It's a bit of a mess around the world. There are points of light where some education systems are doing well. Canada is actually really well aligned
in terms of your enterprise
us.
Education, are you talking?
In terms of enterprise education. Germany actually is doing well in terms of enterprise education.
And pathways to work as well.
And pathways to work. But we need to really, really... I don't think we understand. We're like frogs in the boiling water, actually. We don't understand how urgent this is. We genuinely don't understand that it's urgent because we're in it, and that's why we keep trying to put up these points of light to say, look, there's 30% of 20 to 24 year olds unemployed or underemployed. That's the highest it's ever been. 4.7 years to get a job from education to a job in your field, 2.7 years to get any kind of job. You know, we keep trying to hold up these kind of guideposts in a way to say, do we realise that it's urgent? Let's wake up and understand.
It's true. Really, I mean, it fascinates me the conversations that you have with CEOs and political leaders around the country where the language that they'll use is, we don't have a burning platform. And I'm going, well, what do you need? Because I can paint you a picture of a burning platform right now. I mean, what you've alluded to in the Four Corners episode last night, it's not okay that 30% of young people in this country are unemployed or underemployed. But there's this, quite literally, I have had conversation after conversation over the last couple of months with business leaders who say the only way we're going to get the sort of large-scale reform that we need is if we have another GFC-type scenario happen. I'm going, seriously? With the knowledge that we have, with the smarts in this country, can we not be more proactive than that? Can we not lead now as opposed to needing to be reactive and waiting for a situation to worsen? Like, let's set up for success and lay foundations for being able to be a stronger and more prosperous country now.
Okay. There was a question here, but I'll just quickly go back to the lady who actually originally made the point. Did you just want to come back quickly on that?
I think it's to the young people in the audience as much as anything, not the burning platform. Where the hell's the political engagement? We've now got young kids politically engaged on the climate change issue.
Yep.
Why aren't young kids complaining about lack of jobs and changing their vote accordingly?
Maybe because they don't vote.
Yeah. Well, they are.
They are complaining.
Well, they are.
They are. I was going to say, I have a lot of conversations week in, week out. I get emails every week from young people who are starting these conversations in their communities. I was in South Australia for Q&A last night. There was a good 20 young people in the room who came up and had a chat to me afterwards about the challenges they're facing with youth unemployment, what they're doing to try and raise up the voice on that issue. So we're seeing it. We're seeing the start of that. I hope that will become stronger as we move closer towards a election. I think part of it is there's optimism around this new government's language and narrative. And there's this want to see, are you going to put your money where your mouth is, come the release of the innovation agenda, and we start to see the first workings of what a Malcolm Turnbull government will look like. So I think once some of those responses come out, which are going to be absolutely pivotal to where the jobs are going to be created for young people, that's when we'll start to see the youth react, pending whether or not that's substantive.
Okay. Go right ahead.
I'll be leading that, if not.
I'm employed full-time in finance. I study part-time, and it seems that every day, or everywhere these days, having a undergraduate degree is as common as having a Victorian Certificate of Education. Holly mentioned that in a previous age, knowledge was power, and now maybe ideation is our new power. So I'm curious to know, I'm 25, I'm, I guess, going through this long journey of university and trying to find my career path, and I'm curious to know, what does the resume of a successful person from this younger generation look like? If ideation is our new power?
I think it's different in different parts of the world. I think, unfortunately, and this is the challenge being an employer, there are certain underlying things you can't get away from because the ecosystem has been built like that. So what I mean by that is, for example, an undergraduate degree as a requirement is what everyone looks for as a basic item in certain levels of skills. And it's hard to get away from that. But at the same time, what the current economy offers, where you have an opportunity, is the idea of the contingent workforce and how you're able to do multiple things at the same time, much like yourself, where you're doing a degree and a job. But for a lot of people, I've been on two Uber rides today where the main job of both those people, funnily enough, they were both carpenters in their day job, and they would finish and they would ride a car. Obviously, what interests you, what skills you're after, may mean different things, but the opportunity that you have at least is try multiple things at the same time, and I think we truly have that opportunity more so today than we've had before.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
I'll jump in and add a few thoughts. So I'm a recovering law student, and I graduated from a law degree this time 2 years ago. I'm originally from WA. I live in Melbourne now. My cohort had 900 legal graduates in Western Australia that year. There were 200 legal jobs going in WA. So you think about that mismatch and how we've just oversupplied a market with people that have spent, I mean, what have I got, $55,000 debt for that 5-6 years worth of study. And if I had intended to go out into that career path, then I'm looking at a pretty sad state of affairs in terms of the job opportunities. When I think about what's allowed me to be able to take up the career opportunities that I've had, I think the biggest thing has been experience. And by that, I don't just mean work experience. And I know that's a real challenge for a lot of young people to find too. And one of the big pushes I'm working with industry and business on is how do we facilitate more work experience and internship opportunities? Because the thing young people say to me is, I keep getting beaten out by people who have experience, but where do I get the experience that gives me the experience? And we do need to tackle that. But the incredible experience I've personally been able to get from volunteering in nonprofits, in leading social enterprises, in running projects in my community, the teamwork you can demonstrate, the ability to control a budget, to put in project manage an event, there's unbelievable opportunities, not only to contribute to the community, but at the same time build skills and capabilities that are really going to help set you up for wherever you choose to go. So in amongst the things you're looking at, the study and the work that you're already doing, potentially look at that space as somewhere where you could build your experiences.
And that's what really... that's what really concerns me as someone, because what you're talking about there is you're volunteering your time.
Yes.
So you need to be able to eat and you need to be able to pay your rent.
Well, this is the issue that flared with the New Zealander that was over at the UN living in the tent out the front because he was taking up an unpaid internship.
Right. So I currently in the 7:30 office, we have a woman who's 29 years old interning with us for a month. She's not paid. She is a journalism student, so she's probably not going to get a job. She certainly a job that's going to pay her bills for quite some time. Mm-hmm. She worked in PR and then hated that and decided she wanted to get on the good side of the fence. And so she she's jacked all of that in. But you know, she's of a certain demographic where if it all goes wrong, she can probably go back to her parents and they can probably help her. But she, you know, not everyone's like that. Mm. And so, you know, if we're talking about this big future world, are we only talking to the children of middle class, upper middle class people, or people who are going to basically be living with their parents until they're 40? I don't know.
No, the middle class are in real trouble.
Mm. That's actually why I said upper middle class.
Because I'm being serious. I mean, in the data that's coming out around automation of the workforce, the two groups that will be hit actually the most are entry-level jobs, which is what young people mostly go into, but also mid-level of management is going to be automated, and particularly in your two careers. There's a heap of careers, there's a whole list of them. But that is not, to me, the thing to focus on. The thing to focus on is exactly what these two have said, which is how do you build out a portfolio? How do you think about your working life as a portfolio of both activity, experience, skill sets, and how will you then organise yourself around them? There is no doubt it is more complex, and you already know it, working, studying, add into that a startup, you know, that you're doing with a couple of your friends, add into that some kind of work that you're doing in your community, which, by the way, is probably one of the most significant ways to increase your mental health is to actually contribute into your community and be part of your community. So that's, you know, you're ticking that box. You're ticking a box around working with other people and in startups if you get together with some of your other finance students, which you probably will because there's a heap of you all starting to do new things, coming up with ways to knock off Rashir's platform. And then you've got your job and banks. Then you've got your study. That is genuinely kind of how lots and lots and lots of people are organising their life at the moment under 30. Mm. The challenge for that is, and this is the problem, the challenge is that your parents at that age had a house. Mm. They probably had you, maybe even a couple of other kids. They had a whole heap of stuff that actually you've got a decade, which you can see as I've bought myself a decade. You're going to work to 70 or 80 anyway, so maybe it doesn't matter. But you bought yourself a decade that actually, you know, your parents and their parents didn't have because they were all barefoot and pregnant way earlier than that. But the fact is that, you know, you could see that as a really positive thing that you're building out all these opportunities, but it is that there are some gates that you just cannot open in a way that your parents and grandparents did, which was affordable housing, which was, you know, access to that full-time job, which was the debt then to actually get the debt for that.
This is the new normal. This is the new normal.
So I think we need to be really careful about what we're saying was bringing, you know, the past is the thing we're going after. Actually, the future is very exciting, very different.
Completely.
But we're going to have to change the way that we work around
it. I just want to know when you're going to sleep. You know, it's a real thing. It's an issue, isn't it?
Well, Holly
I
mean, doesn't sleep at all. So she's a really bad example.
All right.
She's very busy.
Let's get some more. Did that answer your question, by the way? It did?
Yeah. Between the three of us, there's something.
Hopefully
there's something there.
Yes, please.
My name is Michael. I'm 23. Michael. And since we got called out for the young people to speak, I thought I would and give my insight. So I'm 23 and I've just started my own social enterprise and I run that full time now.
What are you doing, Michael? What are you running?
A video production studio called Momentary. Nice. So we just work for...
Do you want to say the name louder?
Yeah.
Momentary.com.au. Anyway, so I think that... Because I basically looked at the employment and available jobs and basically went, nah. Partly because I didn't find anything that I liked and also because it's very scarce. And I think that that's a seriously viable option. And obviously you guys are trying to support that. But how do we encourage people and young people and let them see that that is an option to start off with? Because a lot of people don't even see that. A lot of people think full-time or nothing. How do we see that as a viable option and also support them in doing that?
I'm going to plug your work on this because you won't do it yourself.
I love that Michael's it. We did not plant Michael.
Yeah, I swear.
This is the best question.
It's a great question. We've probably all got something to throw in here. But, I mean, what Jan does at the Foundation of Young Australians, for Young Australians is huge for doing exactly that. So trying to create role models, to create the platforms to create more role models that are out there in communities, showing there are alternative ways of doing things that are starting up commercial businesses through to non-profit initiatives, social enterprises, the leading advocacy campaigns. You know, her book, Future Chasers, gives 12 really different examples of sort of the archetypes of ways that you can be contributing and making a go of it that don't look at all like being somewhere 9 to 5 or taking perhaps a traditional career path. So one part of your answer is we need to be out there ensuring the stories of people who are doing things differently are being shared and that people can understand the pathway. Because I think one of the challenges, I know I found this coming out of university, is going, okay, but if I don't do that, how do I do something else? And it's that difficulty of being able to navigate joining the dots into a world that's a lot less certain than, well, I go there and I stay there 9 to 5 and then I come back tomorrow and I do that again. So that whole piece is something we need to make easier. One thing you should look up is a program FYA runs called Young Social Pioneers. So that's to help and support and catalyse people like you to be able to take a concept that you've started and grow it into an even larger, more thriving organisation. And that'd be a great place and a great community for you to join as well.
Something I find entrepreneurs, especially established entrepreneurs, don't talk about very often is the privilege of a safety net. For example, my parents built wealth over time. Originally they were poor, but now they're at a stage where if my business was to fail, I wouldn't worry about my livelihood. A lot of entrepreneurial success I find very often comes from people who have that safety net. I don't mean lots of wealth, but I mean some backing, some savings, some opportunity, something to go back to in case it doesn't work out. And I think, the environment, the way the government looks at this, it doesn't recognize the role of that safety net. Yeah. It's not even spoken about. I think if we were to encourage more people to take on entrepreneurship, to take on contingent work, we're going to have to protect their downside.
And how do you do that? Do you see that as being a better government safety net? Or
I think there is a role there. I obviously don't think it's a massive role. Could Centrelink be better for young people? Absolutely. And there is a place there for that, as well as broader education. A micro example I have of enterprising skills, the CEO of our business in Bangalore sent his son to this school where there is no curriculum. And the sole objective they have is to how to train children to be learners. And they learn at their own pace, they ask questions at their own pace. But the point I'm making is the parents had to go to these workshops for 2 years to prepare for that.
Wow.
So that they could actually make...
How fascinating. That sounds amazing.
Make the transition.
Documentary idea.
So that they don't have expectations.
Right.
Yeah, they don't have expectations from their children that the society puts on them. And that is such a fundamental shift of thinking.
That's so interesting. Awesome. That's really good. Michael, I think, You're right on the money. I mean, you may not be earning money, but you're right on the money. Metaphorically.
You're on your way.
Metaphorically, if not literally, because I know I'm an entrepreneur, so I feel your daily pain. Yeah. But I think that actually we need to acknowledge and understand we are right now today 136,000 jobs short in this country. Yeah. So no matter what you do, we cannot blame the victim, the young person, whoever it is, that they don't have a job. This is genuinely, we're genuinely past that kind of front page, a current affair, doorstop, you know, why are you a bludger? We are beyond that. We genuinely don't have enough jobs. So the biggest challenge is to actually for us to create job creators rather than job seekers. And there's two kinds of entrepreneurs, and it's quite important now that we start to drop down on some of these big stories that we have about things. And entrepreneurship's one of them. Because there are two kinds of entrepreneurs. There's an entrepreneur that's a small business person who sets up something and runs it and is literally it's their livelihood and their income. And if they go well, they can employ a couple of people. And SMEs are big in this country. Often they'll say they're the backbone of the country. Women are very, very, very highly represented in SMEs in this country, something like 75%. And then there's an entrepreneur that is also of a particular demographic and age group that's more about innovation. So they're looking to innovate into ideas or into issues or problems, and that is also in the social as well as in the business but and tech environment. That's what you're doing.
Aren't there some people who are just the worker bees?
Yes, as well. And there will be, I mean, this is number one, those entrepreneurs employ those people. So let's not forget how many people that small business employ in this country, and so will these innovative entrepreneurs. The biggest change in this country is actually going to happen in business and in the corporate environment, because that's where automation is going to hit at scale and en masse, and lots and lots and lots of people, unless they start to rethink their job, start to upskill or think about other things they want to do, are going to be hit. And I'm, you know, our data says that's going to be mums and dads that are kind of in their 30s, late 30s and 40s. That group have not been hit before in such a way as what is coming with automation. So that is really, really, really important. But Michael's in a different place, because Michael, if what he does works, will employ people and will actually also, even from that, Michael, you'll find, and lots of small business people do, that they spawn other small business people, so they end up working together. So there is, you know, there's a great opportunity in what you're doing, and you should stick to it, but you need support.
Yeah.
And you need to find your tribe.
We've probably got one time for probably just the last question, actually, down here. Told you it goes quick.
Yeah, it did.
I'm interested in, I guess, a couple of things that haven't really been touched on, but I'm interested, we haven't really spoken about vulnerable young people who university is not a pathway for them.
Just put the microphone a little closer.
Can you hear me like that?
That's
yeah.
Better. Yep.
The vulnerable young people who university is not going to be a pathway, who may not be able to finish school, who are going to, you know, hopefully get apprenticeships or go through the TAFE system, but may not, and aren't entrepreneurial, and they're going to need a lot of support, and employers are going to need support to employ these young people and get them through. And I guess maybe as a final issue that sort of touches vulnerable young people and perhaps the more engaged cohort that you've been speaking of that hasn't been mentioned specifically is mental health, because it's a huge one. And we've talked about employment and education, but mental health is a huge barrier to young people even being able to sort of enter this world. And so I'd just be interested in some thoughts, I mean, both from the vulnerable perspective and the more engaged perspective of how we're going to tackle or help young people when mental health is such an issue these days.
Big, big, big topic. So on the vulnerable young people.
You've got 4 minutes.
We've got
all
4 minutes.
That's
we'll
a
be
minute
really
each.
Quick. We're going to be really quick. There is, so in our report, we actually focused on Indigenous young people, actually, and we do a lot of work with Indigenous young people at FIA. They are a vulnerable group because in lots of cases of where they live and where they're located, not necessarily because of who they are. So, I always want to make that distinction. It's the same. I spent 15 years of my life working with children and young people in out-of-home care and foster care. They're called vulnerable, but actually they're probably some of the most resilient young people I've ever seen in my life. And when we gave them opportunities to set up their own business, they ran at it. So the people that we think are the most vulnerable may not be the most vulnerable, because actually they have a resilience within them, which is not what actually a lot of other young people have. So aspiration, understanding and changing our perception of young people. So aspiration, all the research around the best work with Indigenous young people in this country has said that having a high expectation and high aspirations has had the single biggest outcome on their life outcomes. So when we dumb it down and when we say go and do this special course, that has actually had the most retrograde impact on young Indigenous people in this country. And by the way, there are still schools across this country that take Indigenous young people out and put them into other classes so it doesn't affect the whole school score. Outrageous, unacceptable. So high expectation, a sense that actually those young people that we think are vulnerable have got incredible internal strength that we need to tap into and draw out and see as a resource. And the only last thing I would say about mental health is that one of the reasons, two reasons about mental health. One is young people are genuinely burdened by the global environment in which they are living, and that is genuine and real. The other thing, though, the biggest antidote to that is actually to get young people having the chance to contribute to something that makes or improves other people's lives. And in that process of contributing, in that process of giving back, you actually derive this incredible benefit, which is greater than probably anything that you give. And we need to build that much more strongly into this, into work with young people. Young people right now in the world and in Australia, particularly in developing countries, have got a very, very singular, individual worldview. That's where we have come to globally. We've come to this, you're on your own, you're running your own race, it's up to you. It's actually not. There is nothing in this world that actually, and when it's all said and done, and I'm talking to you guys, we started here, you need each other and you need your community and you need your family to thrive. It's not only up to you. It is up to everyone else around you and how you support each other, but also about how we ensure that you're prepared and equipped. You're not an island. We don't expect you to be. We don't want you to be. We want you to actually be an incredible community member, which I feel like you actually are. Because you're here.
I think I've seen you guys here before, haven't I?
Yeah.
See? Oh, wow. Well, see? You're engaged in the conversation.
Excellent. All right. So that was a very eloquent way to finish, but I do want to just give a final word to you both, Richie, if you had a thought about the mental health issue or if you wanted to send a message home with people.
I mean, I'm not specifically on that topic, but to say that I think fundamentally as a society we need to change the way we think about young people against experience and go back to the point where we started, which is to actually have belief in the agency of the young people. And FIA does such amazing work in that, because I think that's one way to the engagement point. Yeah. We will actually change, have positive impact on our society by bringing these fresh young ideas and energy into an active role in the ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. Look, I think Jan covered it off so well. I just think the only thing I'd add on the mental health front, which is really just piggybacking on the idea that she finished with, is just the importance of belonging, connection, place. Mm. So alongside this piece on contribution, it's about ensuring that we do have safe public spaces where people can come together, where ideas, conversation can take place. And it is about having that connection. I mean, isolation can't exist where there's strong communities. And one of the things that we need to be doing more and more is thinking about how do we, with every housing development, with every urban development, with every bit of infrastructure we're creating, how are we putting community at the forefront of the way that we're thinking through strategically? The people and the heart needs to come back into how we do everything. And that's part of the way that we need to, I think, start tackling the alarming rates of mental health that we've got.
Well, hopefully you'll go home with lots of ideas and certainly lots of places to find more ideas as well. Foundation for Young Australians, you know, follow Richia, follow Holly on Twitter. They're always posting really interesting things. And, you know, it's not all bad. No. There's good stuff. There is good stuff.
And so
thank you very much. Thanks for all your contributions. I'm sorry we couldn't get through to more of your questions this evening. But if you can join me in thanking Holly Ransom, Richia Punjabi and Jan Owen.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.